Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. We're calling on your help to make your listening experience the best imaginable. All you need to do is take a short survey. Visit acast.com/survey. That's acast.com/survey. Your opinion matters.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 11th of August, these are our main stories. The disgraced US financier Jeffrey Epstein is found dead in prison while awaiting trial. Southern separatists in Yemen seize the presidential palace in Aden, driving out pro-government forces. And Russian riot police arrest dozens of opposition supporters in central Moscow. Also in this podcast...
I think it would be a fun product to have. I'd say it's quite lacking in character.
We'll find if Brexit could threaten sales of Scottish whisky. Now, he once counted President Trump, Bill Clinton and the British royal Prince Andrew as personal friends. Jeffrey Epstein, the disgraced American financier, was due to stand trial next year on charges of trafficking dozens of underage girls for sex. But on Saturday, the 66-year-old convicted paedophile was found dead in his prison cell in Manhattan following an apparent suicide. The US Attorney General Bill Barr said Epstein's death raised serious questions, and the FBI and the Justice Department have launched an investigation. Earlier, our Washington correspondent Chris Buckler told me what information the authorities had released.
They say that Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his prison cell at 6:30 this morning, New York time. And they say that he was taken to hospital but was pronounced dead there, and they are saying it was an apparent suicide. Just to recap on who Jeffrey Epstein was, he was someone who was a multimillionaire who didn't just attend some of the biggest parties in high society, he was someone who organised and hosted them. And there have long been these allegations about very young girls, in some cases, being procured by him and being used for sex. And that case that was being mentioned there from a decade ago, in which he was charged with prostitution offences, that has become extremely controversial in recent months because it seems he agreed to a plea deal at that stage whenever detectives allegedly had found something like 36 underage victims. And in July, he was rearrested and was now facing a series of sexual offences involving the trafficking of young girls.
So many people are asking the question now, how come this all took so long when these allegations and, you know, chunks of evidence have been available for years?
Yeah, and beyond that, it also raises questions about what information detectives and prosecutors had. And certainly some of that was going to be answered in the upcoming court case. There are allegations, we understand, against some prominent individuals, prominent politicians. And certainly if you take a look at Jeffrey Epstein's parties, they were attended by celebrities. They were attended by very important people. They were attended even by royalty. And actually, there have been filings that have been released from a related but separate case, a civil case, in the last week. And in those, there are many allegations against politicians. There's, in fact, a groping allegation against a member of the British royal family, the Duke of York, Prince Andrew. And it's forced some of them to respond. For example, the royal family have specifically said that they categorically deny the allegations, that they are untrue. But it's left victims wondering whether all of the stories will now come out. And certainly we've heard from the lawyers for the alleged victims who have been saying they will push ahead with civil cases and they are determined that the truth will come out.
Now, a lawyer for some of those victims, Lisa Bloom, said she'd still be pushing ahead with the civil cases to reveal the truth of what took place at those parties and seek compensation. Had he lived, he could have faced up to 45 years in prison. Epstein previously served 13 months in jail before being released in 2009. Tim Malloy was the co-author of a book called Filthy Rich, A Powerful Billionaire, The Sex Scandal That Undid Him and All the Justice That Money Can Buy, the shocking true story of Jeffrey Epstein. He's been talking to my colleague Caroline Wyatt.
He was a math whiz from Brooklyn, New York, the son of a sanitation worker from New York City, who ingratiated himself on wealthy men in New York and worked his way up from a prep school teacher to a hedge fund guy to a man who handled billions of dollars for many, many wealthy people. But clearly there was a very dark side to him. In the 80s and 90s, he was known as sort of a modelizer, a guy who went out with a lot of beautiful models. Somewhere in the 90s, he started going dark, and it ended up being 12-year-olds, 14-year-olds, girls he recruited for massages, in quotation, to his mansion in Florida and to his island in the Caribbean and to his ranch in New Mexico. And he just became a serial child molester. And it took forever for him to get caught.
Tell us more about that initial investigation.
He lives in Palm Beach, which is this elegant Monaco-like place in Florida, the most beautiful town in Florida and the oldest, one of the oldest. He had a mansion there like many, many wealthy guys. And he started sending young girls, and they were girls, 18, 19, 20, in some cases young women, to go recruit younger girls at local high schools, shopping malls, and bring them to his across the bridges into Palm Beach and to give him a quote-unquote massage. And he would do this three or four times a day. And the massages were always, there was always something else involved with that. He would try as much as he could with these girls. One girl came home with $300 in her pocket to her lower middle class home in Royal Palm Beach, Florida. Her mom found the money, said, "Are you dealing drugs? What are you doing?" "No, I was giving a massage to a rich guy in Palm Beach." That led to a police investigation, surveillance of his house for 11 months. And there were literally dozens and dozens and dozens of these girls coming over in their cars. And finally, they got him after 11 months through DNA and then finally confessions.
But he didn't end up getting a long prison sentence.
He basically got a slap on the wrist. The state attorney, which is basically the district attorney for the county, considered it just a simple solicitation of prostitution of a minor, which wasn't even a felony. And he knew everybody. He knew President Trump. He knew President Clinton socially. Neither one of them, this is important, underscored this, were ever accused of doing anything wrong with him. But they knew him, and he knew everybody. He knew foreign leaders. He was wealthy, and he was charitable, and he was into science, and he collected people and influence. How did this guy, who could have gotten 20, 30 years, basically walk away?
What do you make of the timing of his death? Because just yesterday, 2,000 pages of documents were released about him and his operations.
Tragedy all around. This guy just wreaked havoc. And now he's dead. And much of what he knows will now not come out.
The author Tim Malloy. Next to Yemen. Now, that's the sound of southern separatist forces celebrating after 4 days of fighting. They've driven pro-government soldiers out of many of their positions in Aden, Yemen's temporary capital. They say they've taken control of the presidential palace and seized all the military camps belonging to the internationally recognised government. Ahmad Mahmoud is a spokesman for Yemen's southern transition forces.
We dedicate this victory to the people of the south after we were victorious over the Islah terrorist party. Thank God. We also dedicate this victory to South Yemen's president, Idrus al-Zubaydi.
Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher told me more.
It could turn out to be quite significant. I mean, we don't know yet. I mean, what's happened essentially is that two major elements in the Saudi-led coalition against Houthi rebels have split. This has been building for a long time. Essentially, you have the presidential guard, the government forces, whose loyalty is to the president, Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, supported by the Saudis, and you have the southern separatists. Now, this is a relatively new group. The separatists have been around for years and years and years, but this group has become more powerful during the conflict, and it's very much been nurtured by the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, which is the other key element of the coalition against the Houthis. Now, they have said for some time that they want to take not just Aden, but all of the south of Yemen. Years ago, decades ago, Yemen was two countries, North Yemen and South Yemen, and it's been the ambition of many Yemenis in the south to restore that. And before this latest conflict erupted more than 4 years ago now, that was one of the main headaches that Yemen was facing.
And from Aden in the south as a headquarters, as a starting point, how easy will it for them to be to fulfil that objective, to take the rest of the south?
It it wouldn't, I think, quite work that way. I mean, I think the significance of this is two things. I think the first is about the internationally recognised government and its authority. It's a major blow to them. I mean, essentially, this is meant to be their temporary capital. This is where the president comes when he leaves exile in Saudi Arabia. This is where ministers are. This is where they're trying to build the country that existed, as far as they were concerned, before 2015 and the Houthis took over up in Sana'a. So I think the key at the moment is them and their reaction, how the coalition, how the Saudis will react. Will they allow this to stand, or will they use the same kind of tactics they've used against the Houthis in terms of airstrikes, in terms of major military attacks to try and retake Aden? As far as the separatists are concerned, we'll have to see what happens in other areas of the south. Will we see similar sudden upsurges by their forces against the military supporting President Hadi? Will they be able to take other major towns, other provinces? That's a very, very open question at the moment. The fact they've done this, though, symbolically, is a big victory for them. But I think practically, it's more the blow to the Saudi-led coalition and to the image of the government.
So there's a long-running struggle for control of Yemen, but we could look back on today as a game-changing moment.
It could be, but the questions really are all up in the air. I mean, think about the Houthis as well. In a sense, the Houthis created this latest round of violence. They launched a missile attack on southern separatists more than a week ago in Aden, which killed dozens of them. Now, this is to some extent a response to that. It exposed the splits between the separatists fighting for the Saudi-led coalition and the other groups. That is a huge divide, which isn't just here, but also in other parts of Yemen where the coalition is fighting over in Hodeidah, a major battleground. Southern separatists are fighting there. Now, we could see, potentially, battles between different groups within the coalition breaking out. So you could see the coalition start to unravel, potentially, which would benefit the Houthis, obviously, which could change the nature of the conflict. Just it seemed to be reaching a point where perhaps the participants, both the coalition, the government and the Houthis, felt that perhaps it had reached a point where the stalemate was so set that there was nothing much more to be gained, and the UN was beginning to have some of its peace moves were reaping benefits. This knocks that back to some extent. It makes it a more fluid situation again, which in a war like this is dangerous.
Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher reporting. And just as we record this podcast, the Reuters news agency are suggesting that the southern separatists in Yemen have agreed to a call for a ceasefire made by the Saudi-led coalition in Aden. A powerful typhoon has struck the east coast of China, killing at least 22 people. More than a million have been forced from their homes, with the authorities setting up temporary shelters. There's been severe flooding and transport has been disrupted by strong winds and high waves. Our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell is watching developments from Hong Kong.
Typhoon Leki Ma has wreaked havoc in southeastern China. Rescue teams are struggling through surging muddy water to reach those trapped by fallen debris. People were killed in Wenzhou after a landslide blocked a mountain river, creating a temporary dam which then burst, flooding communities downstream. The typhoon hit Zhejiang province to the south of Shanghai, forcing more than a million people from their homes. Many of them are spending tonight in emergency accommodation. He Jiliang, an official from Rayan City, said basic necessities were being handed out. In a shelter, we've provided those who've come here with essential items, he said, like a straw mat, water, biscuits, anti-mosquito coils and so on. In this way, they can get through this typhoon in peace. Typhoon Leki Ma is expected to produce heavy rain in the coming days. A warning has been issued for Shanghai and its neighbouring provinces that flash floods and mudslides could follow more torrential downpours.
Stephen McDonnell. Now to one of Britain's and Scotland's most lucrative exports, whisky. Brexit could prove a challenge as a new trade deal with the United States could open the way for cheaper products, namely whisky substitutes that can be made more quickly and sold in the UK. So how good are they? James Shaw's been finding out.
Yeah, that's the mashing you're hearing in the background, and the stage we're at the moment is the third water. Making whiskey is a complicated business. Alistair MacDonald should know. He's been doing it for more than 30 years, first on Islay and now in the brand new Clydeside Distillery in Glasgow. His boss, Andrew Morrison, explains that it is also extremely time-consuming.
Where you're always striving to get to is about a 10 or 12-year-old as your flagship product out in the marketplace. So, yeah, you're looking at pretty close to 20 years as an overall project. And so that has its challenges in itself from a finance point of view, huge capital expense up front. And, yeah, so you have to be very, very committed to what you're doing and passionate about what you're doing and believe that you're really going to deliver something of high quality to the marketplace.
So you might expect Andrew and Alistair to look somewhat askance at a whiskey product which can be made in 24 hours. But that is what a Californian company, Endless West, has done. They say they analysed the composition of whiskey at a molecular level, which meant they could recreate the taste using natural ingredients, but without any maturing process. Whiskey making goes back generations in Andrew Morrison's family, so I wondered if he might like to try this new competitor.
I think it would be a fun product to have, to have comparable tastings with, because it's so different to anything I've tasted that's classed as whiskey. Obviously, it's very young. You do get a lot of the characteristics you expect with young whiskey, which is quite strong alcohol coming through. But there's nothing really there to soften it. I'm not getting any kind of citrusy notes. I'm not getting any smoke. So I'd say it's quite lacking in character.
And so to the really important taste test, not by a rival producer, but by the great Scottish public.
Have a taste, madam. Have some.
Can I just smell it? I don't want to...
It's a whiskey.
Is it?
It tastes like a whiskey.
Is it?
You can't believe it.
You smelled it, madam. What did you think?
She's a whiskey drinker. It's a whiskey drinker.
Is she?
Yeah. I used to like whiskey. I'm not so sure. I don't think it is a whiskey.
Shall I tell you?
I'm a gin drinker.
Shall I put you out of your misery?
Like
that is made in California. It's not matured at all. It's made in 24 hours.
So it
claims to be a whiskey, but it's like an instant whiskey.
You're going to tank the whiskey. That's where you're going to tank the Scottish whiskey with that.
There'll never be a nice single malt.
It's actually quite a nice whiskey. Are you sure they're not imported from Scotch and mixed with it? You know how sneaky they are?
James Shaw reporting. Still to come.
How do you stop having a problem in the first place is potentially at the moment not to go for Hajj. It's a dramatic thing to say.
A warning to Muslims who could be swindled out of thousands of dollars. Now, for the fourth time in a month, tens of thousands of people have been demonstrating in Moscow demanding free local elections. What you can hear there are the protesters chanting quite clearly, fascism will not pass. They're also demanding the release of those arrested during earlier demonstrations. The gathering was authorised in advance, but officially restricted to take place outside Moscow city centre. But a group of about 500 people broke away and headed towards the offices of President Vladimir Putin, where riot police confronted them. More than 170 demonstrators were arrested. An opposition politician, Lyubov Sobol, an ally of the Kremlin critic, Alexei Navalny, was detained by police ahead of the protest. She went on Twitter as the police broke down the doors of her headquarters.
The police are here in the signature collection centre and they're not letting me go to the rally. I want to say that I am not afraid. I am not planning on giving up and I will continue my political activities. They're banging on the doors at the moment.
Our correspondent in Moscow, Sarah Rainsford, says there have also been protests in other cities.
The group that follows these numbers is saying that across the country in four cities at the moment, there are around about 250 detentions. Now, that's a lot lower than we've seen in previous weeks. But counter to that is the fact that this has been the biggest protest that we've actually seen in Russia for many years, back since December 2011. That was the last time there was anything on this scale. Now, I'm talking specifically about the authorised protest that took place just outside the Garden Ring here in Moscow. We understand that around about 50,000 30,000 people turned out for that protest. It was peaceful. There was an awful lot of speeches, chanting, slogans, a lot of anger there. But it was after that, as some people made their way into the city centre, tried to head towards the presidential administration to take their protest right into the heart of Moscow. That's when the police began detaining people, bundling them into police vans and trying to clear the streets of any protesters at all.
And as is quite commonly the case, this is not, you know, people summoning up all this anger about the status of local election candidates. That's been the starting point for something that's become much, much broader in terms of the list of grievances.
I think that's right. But I think that bot ban on opposition candidates at the election was a genuine source of anger and frustration for a lot of people. I think it was almost the last straw for many people. They felt that they were being overlooked, they were being ignored, that they had no choice in elections. And it kind of was almost like the point was brought home to them, how little power they had in their own country. And beyond there, what's happened is that they've now become particularly angry at the way that the security forces in particular and officials in general have dealt with the protests. So extreme force by the police, the fact that so many people have been detained, and the fact that now a dozen people are facing very serious criminal charges, up to 8 years in prison for taking part in peaceful protests on the whole, which the authorities have designated a mass riot. So very serious charges. And today a lot of people were calling, chanting, free the political prisoners. They had posters of the people, many of them young men in their 20s. One of them in particular, many people were carrying his picture, Yegor Zhukov. He's a young student and activist at one of the most elite universities here in Moscow. And I think the arrest of people like that has really angered people. And it has, I think, increased the numbers of people coming out to protest.
Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Negotiations in Doha between the United States and the Afghan Taliban are intensifying amid growing signs a deal could be signed as early as next week. This would include a phased US troop withdrawal in exchange for Taliban guarantees the country wouldn't become a safe haven for extremists. But some former US military figures have warned the deal could see the return of al-Qaeda. Here's our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette.
Both sides say all the main issues in these difficult negotiations have been resolved, but even small technical details are taking time. This is a complex and controversial deal. Some Afghans accuse the United States of abandoning them to the Taliban. Donald Trump has repeatedly made it clear he wants most, if not all, of the 14,000 troops home by next year's presidential elections. There's expected to be a phased pullout. In exchange for Taliban guarantees to stop extremist groups like al-Qaeda from plotting attacks against the U.S. But some former military officers are skeptical, including the ex-vice chief of staff of the U.S. Army, General Jack Keane.
I'm concerned about the imminent peace agreement, which would commit to the United States withdrawing all of its troops in return for a guarantee from the Taliban to ensure that the al-Qaeda does not establish a safe haven again in Afghanistan. And I think we know full well that the Taliban cannot be trusted.
The risks of peace are great, but for many, the pain of war even greater. Afghanistan is now America's longest military engagement. And for Afghans, it feels like a war without end. Any chance of peace, however small, is being seized.
Lise Doucette reporting. The link between obesity and cancer is well known, but new research suggests that risk has been underestimated and is likely to be twice as high as previously thought. Linda Board is a professor of public health at the University of Edinburgh.
Well, it's really related to the fat in our bodies. So fat is obviously one of the things that the body is made up of, but it's not inactive. So fat cells tell other cells what to do in a simple way. And we know that extra levels of things like estrogen, insulin, and also inflammatory chemicals that are in the body that are produced by excess fat means that cells get the wrong messages and they can multiply and duplicate themselves at a faster rate. And when you have faster rates of cell production and particularly division, that's when cancer can occur. So in other words, more cells multiplying more rapidly, there's more risk of things going wrong and it can change DNA and we can have mistakes that are made in the cells. And that's what causes cancer. So really kind of three mechanisms. We know what we call sex hormones, of which estrogen is a main one, insulin, and then also inflammation. Those are three main mechanisms in relation to how we know that excess fat causes cancer. What we've done traditionally is look at what we call cohort studies. So these are large studies. They are just a snapshot. So what the researchers at IARC and University of Bristol have done is they've used a new approach called Mendelian randomization. And that is essentially looking at genetic measures of body weight that can give us, I think, potentially more accurate estimates. And when they compared those Mendelian randomization results of genetic measures with cohort studies, they found that actually it looks like the links between obesity and cancer, based on their methods, have been underestimated. We need to really take this seriously, and we need to be doing the same thing for overweight and obesity, supporting individuals to try and achieve a healthy weight. And that's not just the case for adults, of course. If we can prevent this in childhood, we've got a much better chance of preventing cancers later in life.
Linda Bald of Edinburgh University. Almost 2.5 million Muslims converged on Mount Arafat in Saudi Arabia on Saturday for the most important stage of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. One lawyer is warning Muslims about making the journey to Mecca because they could lose thousands of dollars. Kasim Nawaz says some travel agencies who organise Hajj pilgrimages are swindling their customers. My colleague Valerie Sanderson asked him about his work with the victims of fraud.
There's two aspects to it. One is that you're not getting what you're paying for, and where packages are costing about $12,000, that's a big deal. So a lot of people are calling that fraud of itself. That's happening in, would you believe it, 1 in 3 instances in the UK, whereas the actual scams where people are taking people's money away and not delivering anything, that, according to Action Fraud, is also happening fairly frequently. That's happening in about $5 million worth of cases every single year. So if you work that out, with 25,000 people going every single year, that's about $2,000 they lose each.
And that's happening here in the UK. Do you think it's a global issue, though?
It certainly is. Just by its very nature, with the logistics of Hajj, to actually get what you're paying for is a tricky issue, because you've got a time of year where in a two-week period, the supply is very much less than the demand. So with so much demand, hotels can charge what they like. And it's if there's a double booking in one of these hotels and one of you loses out, then one of you loses out. It's not a case of there being alternatives that you can quickly switch across to.
You are acting for victims. Are people able to get their money back?
At the moment, no. This is the critical issue. There's a real access to justice problem. Not just in the UK, but across the globe. Where you're talking about any package holiday, lawyers have to look at it from a financial perspective and say, well, commercially, is this something that I can actually earn something from? And unfortunately, even with the big numbers involved in Hajj, that's not the case. So there's a lot of things on social media, a lot of pressure put on package sellers through the channels of the general media. But also trading standards were given a budget of £100,000. But what they did was that they would fine these companies but not earn compensation back for those who lost out. So I had a family of 11 who lost the equivalent of about $70,000 between them. That was back in 2012. And I went through every single option for them.
So you're getting involved when there is a problem. How do you stop having a problem in the first place?
That's a very good question. How do you stop having a problem in the first place is... potentially at the moment not to go for Hajj. It's a dramatic thing to say, particularly given that I'm a British Muslim and I went 10 years ago, and I would encourage everyone to go for Hajj. But unless the industry actually does something about it by actually turning around and saying, we'll pay for you to get independent legal advice, and you tell us, and they take the gift of the complaint and actually say, right, we're going to sort this out, or we're not going to sort this out, as opposed to what they're doing at the moment. I mean, at the moment, what they're doing is that they're actually playing with people's understanding of their religious obligations. They're saying this is just a test from God, be patient, or inspiring them about what the faith says about forgiveness. What they're forgetting is the faith says a lot about justice as well.
Kasim Nawaz with Valerie Sanderson. One of the effects of climate change is more extreme weather here on Earth. According to new research, there's likely to be little respite, though, if you're 9,000 metres in the air. More from Jonathan Savage.
If you're flying on a transatlantic flight, one of the things that affects your journey time is the jet stream, currents of air at high altitudes that will either speed up your flight if you have a tailwind or slow you down in a headwind. These currents can reach speeds of 400 kilometres per hour. But in jet streams, there's another more noticeable effect. What's called vertical shear causes the turbulence that can make part of your journey uncomfortably bumpy. A team from England's University of Reading believes that climate change is responsible for a 15% increase in vertical shear since 1979. Professor Paul Williams, who led the research, says the effect goes beyond bumpy flights.
Suppose a plane is taking off and let's say there is two or three times more turbulence in the atmosphere. That means it's more likely to have to try and fly around these patches of turbulence. And that will, of course, extend the journey times and could lead to delayed arrivals. And of course, if the plane is in the air for longer, that means it's burning more fuel, which means there's an economic cost as well, which will presumably be passed on to passengers. And then, of course, planes being in the air for longer puts more CO2 into the atmosphere.
The aviation industry accounts for about 2% of global CO2 emissions. According to analysis by the British newspaper The Guardian, a single flight from London to Edinburgh generates more carbon dioxide than a person in Uganda or Somalia produces in a whole year. Professor Williams fears there are more revelations to come.
The fact that this change has been going on to the jet stream above our heads for the past 40 years without anyone noticing until this week when we published our study, it does make me wonder, what are the other ways in which the climate is changing that we haven't yet realised, because the people just haven't done the right study and looked in the right place yet?
His team are among those who fear for the future. They assume that unless drastic action is taken on climate change, the amount of severe turbulence in the atmosphere could triple by the year 2080.
Jonathan Savage reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.